Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
We've talked more than once on this show about threats to endangered animals like elephants, birds, marine mammals, and bats. But lions, somehow they seem invincible. With wild populations dwindling, though, and the recent outrage over the trophy-hunted Cecil, it's clear the king of the jungle could be deposed by human activity. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is passionate about the welfare of these majestic big cats, and he is sensitive to concerns local populations have about the safety of their families and their livestock in areas where lions roam free. The challenge is getting animal welfare advocates and landowners and governments to work collaboratively to maximize human and feline well-being. Craig Packer is director of the Lion Research Center at the University of Minnesota. His new book is called Lions in the Balance: Man-Eaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. Craig, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
The University of Minnesota, I will confess, seems like an odd home base from which to study lions. Tell us about the program there.
Well, Minnesota is very understanding that it doesn't have the most hospitable climate year-round, and so they've been more open than a lot of places might have been for an itinerant faculty member who would like to go to Africa for months on end. So we have been the host of the Serengeti Lion Project, which is one of the longest-term animal studies anywhere on Earth, for decades. And I've had a series of students looking at a number of different issues about lion behavior, ecology, genetics, and health. We've also looked a little bit at some conservation issues, which drew us into the eye of the storm when it came to trophy hunting and other aspects that can be popular with some people but not with others, including deciding that really a lot of problems could be solved if wildlife areas were fenced in a way to separate them from local populations.
I've been thinking about this because I feel strongly that there should be a place for lions to live and roam freely and safely, but I have to admit that I might feel different if I lived in a place that bordered on the natural habitat for lions. Talk a little bit about what, you know, local populations in lion areas have to deal with and how fencing makes a difference.
Well, in a lot of places you have, in rural Africa, you have such abject poverty that people live in very simple huts, and they're farmers. And so they have to get that crop in this year no matter what. Otherwise, their family will starve. And for whatever reason, they don't have fences around their fields, and agricultural pests will raid their crops at night, particularly the bush pig, which is a wild species native to Africa. And in a lot of these areas, there happen to be lions. This is in southern Tanzania. There happen to be lions for whatever reason, and the only thing for them to eat is the bush pig. So the lions follow the pigs into the fields and find people asleep, and then they realize eventually this is a new item for their diet. And it's a horrible situation because, you know, from the farmer's point of view, they're either going to starve or they run the chance of being selected by a lion. The scope of this was really quite horrific about a dozen years ago. Beginning at around the turn of the millennium, there were about 100 cases of man-eating in southern Tanzania every year. And so imagine what it must have been like in relatively small areas. I mean, these would not have been, in terms of geography, not much bigger than, say, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And you'd have an attack once a month. And imagine how, you know, Texans would have reacted if there were man-eating lions out there.
And the population, the human population of Tanzania has really exploded over the past few decades.
Yes, the human population globally is showing signs of hope in that most continents, the people have gone through what's called the demographic transition. So instead of preferring having large families of six or eight kids, in Europe, Asia, most of Latin America and North America, people prefer to have two. But in Africa, people are so incredibly poor, maternal mortality is so high, and women's education is lacking, that it's still the case that people want to have six or eight children. So since I started working in Africa about 40 years ago, the population of Tanzania has quadrupled. Wow. And you go from 10 million to 50 million, that's a pretty big jump. But if that continues and it quadruples again, 200 million people in an area the size of, say, California, Oregon, and Nevada, that's really going to be the end of it. Unless there are entirely new approaches to try to conserve these dangerous animals that inflict so much harm on local people.
Craig, what are the ideal conditions for lions to thrive in the wild without any human intervention?
Lots of food, mm-hmm. so lots of wildebeest, zebra, gazelle, and basically no people. Because if there are people that they'll eat or there's livestock that they'll kill, then they're a menace. Mm-hmm. And they are very, very unliked by local people.
One thing that fascinated you about the study of lions specifically was the degree to which they cooperate with one another. Can you talk about how they sort of share the load of what needs to be done to keep pride healthy?
Yeah, the lion is a phenomenal kind of exception to what we think about in terms of felines and cats. I mean, have you ever had a cat?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's, you know, maybe not the friendliest of the cats.
Not that fond of me, and, right.
Yeah, or fond of anything in particular. And so they're not, we don't think upon them as being the warm and cuddlies in terms of associating freely with each other. They're very solitary. But then you have the lion, which alone amongst all those cats, they do love each other. They're so affectionate to each other. They flop on top of each other. They rub each other. They lick each other. And it's very endearing to watch them in those settings. And so there's a number of contexts in which that kind of behavior stands out. They do hunt together, but they're not as cooperative in their hunts as is often believed. There's a lot of kind of strategizing, like, you know, there's Matilda. She's the best hunter in our pride. Let's let her do all the work and we'll join her at the dinner table. And they also will nurse each other's young. I mean, you get females who give birth about the same time. And the cubs sometimes seem to just go haphazardly from one female to the next looking for milk. But if you look at it in detail, in fact, the cubs are very strategic. And they're waiting till all the mothers are asleep. And they'll sneak a suck on an auntie or a cousin rather than their own mother. So it's a lot of complexity there. And it's not nearly as generous as one might ordinarily think. But there's one context where they are really cooperative, and it's that life and death situation when they encounter a neighboring group. And so a lion pride is like a gang, and what keeps them together and is so important to them is defending a joint territory that has really excellent opportunities to find food. There's water holes and there's good cover where they can hide their cubs. And in those situations, they're always up and at them if there's a stranger that comes into their area. And when it's over, you know, they're very careful to make sure that they've eliminated or at least repelled any invaders from their territory.
What happens to the cubs of a pride if, say, the dad is killed by a trophy hunter or by some other accident or some kind of problem?
So the lion pride has an extraordinary degree of interdependency. And so I've described a lot of the behaviors of females. But now let's turn to dad. And the males in the pride are also very important to the well-being of that group. The males are competing against other males for mating opportunities. There's many more males out there in the population than can hope to breed at any given time. So there's kind of a waiting list. And the males that are in the pride are very protective to make sure that they have exclusive access to their wives, both in terms of mating and, you know, being able occasionally to scavenge from them. Or sometimes the males catch buffalo and feed the whole pride. So they're family members. But they're in a hurry. And if you have a new set of males taking over a pride, cubs take 2 years to grow up and become safe from attacks by incoming males. Hmm. And so the new males, if they're small cubs, they don't want to have stepchildren because those small cubs are like contraceptives that prevent the mothers from coming back into breeding condition for maybe 2 years. And so when the males are in a hurry, they come in and they simply eradicate. They eliminate all the small cubs. They chase out the older ones, force those older cubs and subadults to become wandering nomads, which is a pretty miserable existence too. So with sport hunting, that can exaggerate that frequency because instead of natural mortality, you know, that the father occasionally is going to be killed by other lions or stumble into a problem with buffalo or something. But if you have sport hunters who come in and they target the adult males, then that's going to increase the frequency of these takeovers. And so we looked at this. One of my graduate students in Minnesota was quite interested in the impacts of sport hunting. And we ran basically a computer simulation where we estimated what the impacts would be. And her great insight was that it really depended on the age at which you harvest these males. And so for this, you have to keep one thing in mind, that while we think of a trophy male as being a full-grown animal with a huge, splendid mane, in many places, hunting has been so excessive that all those fully grown males are gone. And so what's left for the clients to come and shoot are younger and younger animals. And in the course of her research, she realized that in some places, all that were left were like teenage lions, like middle school lions. And in lion terms, that'd be like 2 or 3 years of age, barely old enough to impregnate a female, and certainly not big and strong enough to hold on if there were real adult males around. But if they're shooting that many males, then every year they would get replaced. And so every year there would be infanticide, and that would actually cause the population as a whole to decline. And so when we started trying to work with the hunting industry, our first goal was to get them to stop shooting these underaged animals, let them live long enough to take over a pride at a proper age, which is about 4, and then leave them alone for a couple of years so that their young would be old enough to survive any subsequent takeovers. So as a rule of thumb, they should wait till their cubs, they should wait until the males are at least 6 years of age before they're harvested. And that would be kind of setting up a sustainable hunting quota.
Let me jump in here.
That was the idea.
Yeah, we have to take a quick break. I want to hear more about how that worked out in just a moment. My guest is Craig Packer, who is director of the Lion Research Center at the University of Minnesota and author of the new book, Lions in the Balance, Maneaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the director of the Lion Research Center at the University of Minnesota. Craig Packer has just written a new book called Lions in the Balance, Maneaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Craig, just to step back here for a moment, I want to make sure that everybody heard and understands this. If lions are killed for whatever reason, but particularly by trophy hunters, before, this is male lions, before they have reached a certain point in their maturity, shooting down one lion may be indirectly responsible for the deaths of a number of others.
Yes, that's correct. The dad is the protector of its pride, and he needs to have enough time to ensure that his current brood of offspring can survive without him in case of his death. And so with the practices that were widely followed in Africa, people were shooting such young males that the turnover was guaranteed to be very rapid, and thus infanticide more common. And we actually were able to collect some good indirect measures that overhunting was causing populations to decline in many parts of the continent.
Some people may be surprised to learn that you believe there could be a place for responsible trophy hunting.
The key word is responsible. As my last statement emphasizes, lion hunting was really quite poorly managed in most countries. The host countries were viewing quotas for lions not as limits, but as production targets. And so the way they would make money was through selling the dead animals. The more animals that were shot, then the more income that was going to the host nation, to the operators, etc. And this is without any regard on the fact that their offtakes could harm the overall population. And it was quite clear in many cases that they'd been driving down their populations, and their response was just to raise the quotas or raise the production limits and try to milk yet more out of the habitat, and it just wasn't possible. So I started out having grown up in Texas myself. Mm-hmm. I'm from Fort Worth originally, and I used to do a lot of hunting with my family out in, on the family farm out near Abilene, Texas. So I was completely willing to accept the possibility that if hunting was done responsibly, that it gives a justification for setting aside the land for wildlife rather than for farming, rather than for you know, building another mall or something, and that this would have a place. There's a lot of places in Africa that are splendid, and we all want to go and visit them, like the Serengeti and Ngorongoro Crater, Kruger National Park. These are glorious wildlife spectacles with fabulous scenery, high abundance of animals. And so the revenue that can support those areas is largely drawn from phototourism. You go in, you pay your park fees, you drive around. If you see something you like, you take a picture of it, but you don't shoot it. But in other areas, the habitat is scruffy. It's a lot of scrub. It's flat. There's lots of tsetse flies. There might be a lot of other things that are unpleasant to endure. You wouldn't take your kids there. And the odds of seeing an animal are pretty low because the density of wildlife is not really high. But these areas are important too, and ecologically. And in a country like Tanzania, about 80% of the overall wildlife habitat was set aside as hunting blocks. So, okay, that's been designated as hunting blocks. You're going to have it that way. If they didn't hunt them, there's a risk it would all be converted to farming or something else. So my viewpoint was, let's go in there and see if we can help them do this in a sustainable way that will actually be good for the wildlife populations. But, you know, the lesson after a while was that they didn't care.
You got yourself banned from Tanzania.
Yes, I've been banned from Tanzania for trying to help reform the hunting industry. I was actually a member of the Tanzanian delegation, the government delegation, to a CITES meeting in Bangkok about 10 years ago. CITES is the Convention for the International Trade in Endangered Species. And so, you know, I was in the bosom of the family. I was part of the hunting fraternity there. But after a while, it became clear that our recommendations were mostly just providing a smokescreen. And then, in fact, what was most important was maintaining the status quo. And so as I got more concerned about the hunting industry claiming that they were actually only shooting older males, they're being very responsible and everything, then there was no evidence to say that that was really going on. And in fact, you'd see some incredibly fraudulent claims being made amongst their, you know, their commercial literature about what they were doing. And so I wanted to make sure that as international regulatory agencies go forward, that when they're considering putting the line on the endangered species list, as the American government is right now, or CITES is thinking about putting the line on Appendix 1, which would ban all commercial trade and lion products, that they should base their decision on the best available knowledge and not just the self-reporting of the host nation, but in fact on objective measures, open and transparent data. And, you know, in Tanzania, they very much have a lot to hide and they keep hiding it. And so I was relaying my concerns about the corruption and everything to the American government when what was meant to be a confidential email was posted on a public website, got back to Tanzania. And since a lot of the very powerful politicians in countries like Tanzania have received hunting blocks themselves, it's a form of political patronage to be awarded this land that you can then rent off to some foreigner. You know, I ran afoul of some very powerful people out there. And eventually I was denied the renewal of my research clearance, having worked there for 35 years and, you know, having gone from working with the government to now being expelled by the government.
I learned reading your book that it's not a really complicated thing to be able to tell the age of a lion from a distance. I suppose if you have a pair of field glasses, their noses change as they mature.
That's right. So actually enforcing these laws that they wrote is not that terribly difficult. I mean, the client can be told whether it's too young or too old before they actually raise their rifle. And then, of course, after it's been shot, there are a number of ways that you can estimate the age based on its skeleton, its teeth, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, one of the things about the way hunting takes place, that it is quite feasible for the hunters to know something about the age of the lion before they decide to shoot it, is that most of these animals are actually shot on baits. So there's plenty of time to see the animal. There's not a whole lot of sport involved with it. It's a matter of, you know, going to an area where the operators have found some lions that they've baited and they've kept on the bait till the client arrives. And they may not be truthful in saying that they've done that. And they'll say, oh, look, we've got a lion and a dead buffalo. You're so lucky. But there's plenty of time for the company to know exactly what they're doing before they allow it to be shot.
Can you help me understand? I try to keep an open mind about these things. I can understand why people hunt to eat food. It is harder for me to get my mind around why people want to shoot an animal just to say they shot it.
I don't get it either. And as I said, I went into this, you know, based on the knowledge that, well, this land has been set aside. This is a lot of territory that could support a lot of lions indefinitely. But why you would want to shoot something like that is beyond me. I mean, the thing about a lion is it's such an incredible animal. It's its vigor. It's that energy. It's not just the way it looks. It's just the way that it just expresses all that power in its movements and its gestures. And so why anybody would get a thrill of, you know, snuffing that out and then having a very inert, moth-eaten trophy, I just don't get it. But there are people like that. And so you could, in a way, say that sport hunting is kind of a tax on that kind of personality, and that you rely on there being enough of those people that they would raise the money.
What did you learn about lion manes and how, like, a dark, glossy mane makes a lion extra sexy to lionesses?
Well, lion manes are a fascinating feature. I mean, it is one of the reasons why I think why they have such a preeminent status in popular culture. It's the mane that makes them look just so fantastic and a little bit more anthropomorphic. And it turns out that the mane, there's two aspects of it that are unusual. It's that long hair, but it's also a contrasting color. And the most impressive male lions have a big black mane. So we set out a series of experiments where we got some life-size toy lions, and we set them out two at a time and gave the real lions a choice between, say, a long mane or a short mane, or a blonde mane and a black mane. And it turned out that for the females, and these are the key choosers in the mating game, that they were a little bit interested in length, but what really turned them on was the darker mane. And when we gave them these choices of black mane males, they almost always chose the black mane. They would go up to the black mane toy, kind of wave their rear end around it and kind of hope to get some attention in return. They often seemed quite disappointed that the male was just standing there.
It's like, come what am I doing wrong?
What's wrong? Yeah, they're kind of sniffing under their armpits. What's, you know, is it me? And so they were absolutely smitten with these guys. So after we realized that it was color that was such an important characteristic, we looked more into that. And it turns out that mane color in lions is not at all like human hair color, which is if you don't dye it or you get old, it's going to be the same color your whole life. But for a lion, the color of the mane depends on what kind of condition they're in, and that's physical health. And only males that are at the best peak physical condition can grow a really dark mane. So these are superior individuals in the population. The blonde mane males are kind of wimpy in comparison to the black mane ones. And we found that the black mane males, they had more testosterone, they're more aggressive. They're more likely to survive wounds. So they really are superior individuals.
My guest is Craig Packer. He's director of the Lion Research Center at the University of Minnesota and author of a new book called Lions in the Balance, Maneaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. Join us at 800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet. My handle is Chris Boyd Think. Thanks.
Thank you.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is THINK on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the director of the Lion Research Center at the University of Minnesota, Craig Packer. His new book is called Lions in the Balance, Man-Eaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. Join us at 800-933-5372. So, Craig, we've talked about trophy hunters who, largely speaking, come from abroad to hunt these animals, sometimes in a way that is sustainable, very often not. There are also local populations who hunt lions because they feel that they're a danger to their lives and livelihoods, and sometimes they do so because it's part of traditions that they have. It's a ceremonial thing.
Yes, that's right. There's a number of tribes in Tanzania that it's an incredibly important rite of passage. And so you have pastoralist people like the Maasai who spend all their days with their cattle. They literally sleep with them at night. They have the corral right next to their little huts. Sometimes youngsters sleep in with the livestock. And so since there are times of year where the normal prey for the lions might have moved somewhere else, if you have a migration like in the Serengeti, then there's not much else for those lions to eat except livestock. And so there's been a long, long-standing battle between the two species, humans and lions. And I think that's probably what makes this such an important ritual for them, because the lions eat cows, and that's the most important measure of wealth in Maasai society. They might also have sheep and goats, but those belong to the women. And, you know, the men, it's a patriarchy, so, yeah, that's bad luck for them. But the cow, that's a big deal. And so the lions are really the only predators that are cows. And the lions also have an unfortunate habit after they've killed a cow. They're a bit too macho about the whole thing. So if you compare, say, a hyena that may have killed some sort of livestock, once they see any sign of humans, they just run. And they're run, and they're just gone. And so the Maasai are never going to catch up with them. Leopards are very good at hiding. You can't find them. But when lions kill a cow and they see people coming, they growl and they go off to the nearest, say, riverbed or thicket. And then as the people get too close, they growl at them. So it's pretty easy for you to locate them. And so there's an animal that routinely causes you problems you can routinely get back at. And so sometimes they kill in retaliation. There's a lot of that, in fact. And other times it's purely because you've got a bunch of young men and they've just been to a wedding or a funeral or some gathering. And maybe they've had some a little bit too much exciting time and they've got some energy to burn. And what are we going to go do? In the past, there were two different things they might do. One might be to go steal some cattle from a neighboring tribe, because according to Maasai theology, all the cattle in the world belong to them. And so they just they can claim kind of eminent domain of their livestock from their neighbors. But the other is, of course, to go kill a lion. Now, as neighboring tribes are better armed these days than they used to be, including AK-47s, the village elders aren't so keen to lose their young men to a hail of bullets nearby, and so they've discouraged them from doing any more cattle raids. So this just leaves the lion as the big thing they can do. And so when they want to go do that, you've got to somehow anticipate where it's going to happen and try to talk them down. And there are a number of projects that have been starting in East Africa that attempt to do just that. One project like that's called Lion Guardians. It's found in Kenya. And what they've done is to try to replace the Maasai spears with radio antenna, so for radio tracking. So you see these guys going out holding a big, and it looks like a TV antenna, and they're pointing it in different directions. And so the hope there is that they keep close enough tabs on the lions that, oh, there's a lion near this particular boma, that's a little household corral. And so, therefore, this family needs to be extra careful in herding its livestock. Or, ooh, that fence needs to be fixed right around the boma. So that's the idea, is to make them now lion guardians instead of lion killers. And they provide a nominal salary as an incentive to do this. And so there's some limited evidence that this is working reasonably well in parts of Kenya. My research team is continuing to try to do something like that in an area in Tanzania. But, you know, it's early to see how long this is going to last. And there's also the question that, you know, how long are these traditional pastoralist societies going to survive the 21st century? In some places in Africa, like in Botswana and Namibia, where you used to have young men out guarding the livestock 24 hours, all the hours of daylight, that was their method of protection. What we use in North America instead are cattle fences. And what we try to do is to make sure that we've got our livestock completely protected so we don't have to watch them. And so, you know, hunters and cattlemen made sure to eliminate wolves through most of the lower 48 in order to protect their livestock, and then therefore they can just keep things in fences and you didn't have to watch them hour by hour. And so as standards of living are rising in parts of Africa, that's happened in Botswana. And so, you know, we're not out there watching all the time, and so it's more of the American attitude, well, we better, you know, just get rid of the wildlife in those areas. So we'll see if these Lion Guardian projects are going to be still useful 20, 30 years from now, as one really hopes that a lot of these societies do go through adequate economic development, that kids go to school instead of standing around all day watching the rear end of a cow, and that there are more opportunities that are, you know, pay more than, again, just standing around with their cattle.
Let's go back to the phones, and we have Hari on the line in Dallas. Hi, Hari.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a comment. I think we should stop using the word trophy hunting. What I mean is I'm 5'6" tall. I'm a small guy, but I can probably take a gun and with somebody's help go to Africa and hide on a tree or somewhere with electronic goggles and shoot an animal that has absolutely no chance of even getting back at me. That's not hunting. I mean, if you go back 100 years, ago, maybe then people were really going with spears and daggers and really facing an animal and killing it, and maybe they can claim the victory. But I think this is not hunting anymore. If we are never giving the animal a chance to even see that there is an attacker or an opponent or somebody in the area.
Hari, thanks for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Craig?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There are, you know, we have a lot of hunters in this country, and they do a lot of good for conservation. And I think the most easy-to-grasp example of that is an organization like Ducks Unlimited, where you have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of duck hunters who are eager to protect wetlands. So they make an enormous contribution to the protection of waterfowl. And then there are hunters, and I'll stick with the word just for the moment, who in this country want to go out and shoot bear, mountain lions, etc. But this is in a country where, you know, there's good regulations and there's good oversight. And so everything is reasonably well regulated. And then in Africa, the real contrast is that the sport hunting there is not really run by a well regulated agency. It's mostly run by businessmen who are trying to make a profit in the short term. And so they're less careful. They're more interested on the bottom line than on long-term conservation. But even there, you're going to have often two kinds of clients that go to these areas. There are what the industry would refer to as hunters and shooters. And the hunters are people who probably come from the kind of background here where, you know, the idea of going out and being in nature and stalking things and taking some chances, that's all part of the deal. And so in the end, it doesn't really matter to them so much if they get the trophy, because what they wanted was the experience. They wanted the challenge. And I've met some of those people who said, you know, the best experience they ever had was they were tracking some large animal like an elephant or a lion. They tracked it for days. they finally got a good look at it and decided, nah, it wasn't big enough. But that was fun. That was fun going out there and being there. And in contrast to the shooters, and the shooters are more and more common, it seems, in terms of the population of the client. Because these are people who, you know, they don't want to be away from their BlackBerries or their email for very long. They've had to pay for a long safari to be able to get permission to shoot a lion or a leopard on their quotas. And if they can shoot everything in the first 2 days, great. Then they can go back. They've got their rugs and that's it. And again, within the industry, there's not much respect for those shooters, but those are the clients. And so that's often what they have to put up with. And I think that it's a good question whether there'll be any hunters at all after the next few generations, and even how many shooters there'll be. I think the shaming that went on with the Walter Palmer who shot Cecil, mm-hmm. and every now and then we're seeing this with, especially for women who still come to Africa. There was the woman who claimed that she shot a giraffe because it was such a dangerous animal. You know, a lot of loopy stuff there.
They're all over Facebook for sure. Yeah,
they're all over Facebook, and there's a lot of shaming. And I get the feeling that that whole industry is doomed in the long term, not only because they're failing to protect the wildlife, but there's also less and less tolerance for doing that kind of bizarre behavior.
Craig Packer is director of the Lion Research Center at the University of Minnesota and author of the new book, Lions in the Balance, Maneaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. Craig, thank you so much for making time for us.
You're very welcome.